This is KUT Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT. I'm Jennifer Staten. Austin City Council members are moving toward a first vote on the Land Development Code rewrite. You might have heard about the code, the rules that determine what you can build on a piece of land in Austin. We're going to hear from Avez Azar. He's an affordable housing advocate and serves on the city's planning commission, though here he is speaking just for himself. Azar believes the Land Development Code rewrite would boost affordable housing in Austin, but he says there is still room to do more.
There is, I think, two major things that the, or I would actually say three major things that the code does. One is we have a more robust density bonus program. So for folks who do not know what a density bonus program is, it's essentially a program whereby we provide developers with an incentive in the form of increased entitlements. And in lieu of that, they have to either provide on-site affordable units or they have to pay a fee in lieu that goes towards affordable housing. And these are what we call income-restricted housing, in that you have to have a certain amount of income based on formulas and criteria. And if you meet that, only then are you eligible to be in this housing. And that is certified. So your rent is certified. And we have these units for both ownership and renter. So that's one of the things. We've had those in the past. We've expanded them substantially under the new code. And so they're spread out all over the city now. They're not geographically constrained as they were before. So it's a much more robust program. That's, I think, one major thing. Another thing that we're doing is, and I know I really have to appreciate our council for bringing this up, is really preserving our what we call naturally occurring affordable housing. And so, again, let me just explain what naturally occurring affordable housing is. These are not income-restricted housing. They do not have any subsidy or program or any policy that is linked to them through the public means, but essentially have become affordable over time. And this can be either by their makeup, they're smaller in size, or they're more aged out, they're older now, and some of their condition is different. So these are what we call naturally occurring affordable housing. Essentially, these are market rate units that are affordable to a certain number of people and are relatively affordable. And so our council said, well, let's go ahead and preserve these. So one of the things that they had asked staff to do, and that is part of this, is that we do not have any increased entitlements on any of this housing. So staff went and identified this housing and decided that we're not going to bump up the entitlements. Essentially, they stay on their lot as is, and they're not going to have a lot more development incentive in them, so that we do not incentivize redevelopment. Now, I will be very honest, there's two or three issues that still remain. One major issue is these are market rate units. We cannot stop anyone from flipping them over. And we see this all the time in Austin, whether somebody redevelops the entire property or essentially what I've, we call the lipstick on a pig. We put in the granite countertops, put on a splash of paint, and suddenly the rent goes up. And we see this all over the city. I've lived in, units where that's happened. So we cannot stop that regardless of what we do in the code. The other piece of this is we're currently in the code. You can have a bonus incentive. So if you do a certain number of affordable housing, you can actually go ahead and go to a higher level of entitlement. So you're participating in the density bonus program that I talked about. So what that does is, and I think there's some, there's a little bit of nuance here, which is essentially, so you might decrease the number of affordable units because you're going from whatever number there was to a lesser number. But there's a big difference in that you have now have income-restricted housing. For 40 years for rental, for 99 years for ownership, nobody can kick you out. Nobody can increase the rent. Nobody can do any of those things that I just talked about. But those still remain as pressures that we might want to figure out if there's a way to disincentivize redevelopment.
And you said there was a third thing that you think the rewrite of the Land Development Code does for affordable housing in Austin. What's that third item?
So I think the third thing is really providing more housing choice. And I think this is not related to what we call capital A affordable, that's income restricted, but essentially increasing the level of affordability through the number of housing choices that we have. Currently, a lot of what our code allows is you can either live in large multifamily complexes or you can live in single-family homes. It's very hard to find those things in the middle. And what we know from data around the country and what we know pretty much from Austin as well It's what we call that missing middle in the middle. And I'm talking about the housing typology, not income here. So certain those units that are smaller in size actually happen to be more affordable, what were traditionally what we call the mom and pop apartments. And we see these in large parts of our older parts of town. And so we would like to encourage more of that kind of development. We know that it's relatively more affordable. It's not capital A affordable. And the other piece of that conversation is also that people have more housing choice. I'm not going to say a name. I have a friend who lived, you know, she and her husband lived in a single family home in an established central city neighborhood for a while. They're retiring. Their children have left home. They just didn't feel like their large single family home was serving their needs anymore. And fortunate for them, there were actually condos down the street that were smaller that they could go ahead and purchase. So they sold their house, they moved into the condo, which is better size, you know, it fits them better. They don't have to do as much maintenance. It is more affordable in terms of how much taxes they would have to pay on it. And so we talk about this housing choice, which I think comes both in terms of some degree of affordability because of its very nature, and then also because of just having more housing choice in where we want to live and how we want to live.
So a term that's come up in this conversation that I would love to hear a little bit more about is high opportunity areas. What is the kind of opportunity we're talking about, and how does that manifest itself in the code rewrite proposal?
And so high opportunity areas are essentially areas that have been defined through various data and metrics, and this conversation has been happening around the country. Areas where we have better outcomes in terms of employment, better educational outcomes, we see better schools, better access to parks, and certain things like that. And so we as a city have long held this belief that we need to provide more housing and more housing options in high opportunity areas. And so really in the code, we've made a move in that direction. We've increased some of our housing capacity or income restricted housing capacity in high opportunity areas. I think it is something on which we need to keep working on and pushing in that direction, because really we have to ensure, this is a two-part question for me. One is we really have to ensure that we provide housing in areas where opportunities exist for our communities to really thrive and have affordable options in those neighborhoods. And the other part of the conversation is we've had parts of the city that have been historically exclusionary because of, we talk about the 1928 master plan, we talk about our historic injustices, racially restrictive governance. How do we create a more equitable city means we move more for housing in high opportunity areas? Because this conversation cannot simply be about equal increase in entitlements or equal dispersion of housing. It has to be a conversation about equitable dispersion of housing, which really includes us focusing on high opportunity areas.
In our discussion today and in a lot of discussions about the Land Development Code and the rewrite of it, we're hearing the phrase and using the phrase affordable housing. We're using the word affordable. In Austin, what is considered affordable housing?
In terms of defining affordability, we have this criteria that is used by federal programs. This has been used for decades by the federal government for all of its housing programs, like public housing, Section 8, etc. And essentially, there is what we call MFI. People will hear this often.
What is MFI?
MFI is median family income, and it's often sometimes known as area median family income or household median income. It's essentially what the federal government has calculated is the median income for your region. So this includes Austin-Round Rock region and what our median family income here is. And we define affordability based on a percentage of that. So in our programs, we're going to more standardized format, which I think is great. We're now saying that for rental, you have to be making 60% of the median family income. And for ownership, you have to be making 80% of median family income. And so let me just be clear, like, what does that actually mean? And in the 2019 limits that we have, 60% for renters would be $56,760 for a four-person household. And then similarly, at 80%, it is $75,550 for a family of four.
That still sounds like a lot of money to be affordable in Austin.
Yes, and I think that is very true. So there's two things to this again. One, I have to be careful. I'm talking about a four-person household, and the calculation goes from one person up to eight-person household. So the number of people you have, your income limit kind of keeps on increasing. But you're right that this is actually a hard number. It's 60% and 80% MFI. We are really serving folks that essentially do not fall into what we call the deeper affordability. And for deeper affordability, what we keep on talking about and hearing is we kind of need subsidies to go in that. So we have been very fortunate. We have a community that is committed to that. And so we have our affordable housing bonds. We have a housing trust fund. Our council has been committed to finding other policy programs to really target that. And then we have the low-income housing tax credits from the state. So those are meant to really subsidize the deeper affordable side because you need a subsidy on top of anything. What we're getting through our density bonus programs, we have to be careful, is these are completely policy-driven programs. There is not a single dollar of public subsidy that goes into them. This is only the market and a developer producing them without any subsidy. So we get to sort of a shallower affordability, not as deep as we want, and I think we have a commitment. However, I think one thing I want to clarify is we hear this all the time from folks. Let's be honest, right? So I think it sounds like, well, you know, $75,500 is so high. Who's making that? But for ownership, we know there are people out there who earn that much who cannot afford a home in our city. And so for them, this is a big deal. We talk a lot about this gap in the middle. There's people who are served by the deeper affordable subsidized units and the people who are served by the market. And there's a large chunk in the middle that is not served by anyone. And they often feel this push and end up moving out of our city or to other parts.
Isn't there a difference between being able to afford getting into a house and then being able to afford staying in the house? So paying a mortgage, paying upkeep, all the things that come with home ownership that don't come with either apartment rental or home rental. I mean, it seems like there's a difference there.
Exactly. And I feel like in ownership particularly, so one thing is the way it's calculated based on that, and then it's subsidized in that when you're going in, you're only paying 30% of your income towards housing. So you should not be spending less than one third of your income towards owning this unit or renting this unit. So that's the other piece of that affordability that I should have mentioned. And so what we see essentially is that there are certain programs that our city has. We support people in becoming homeowners. And we try to make sure that people are able to stay in their homes through these means because you're really paying lesser than what you would on the market. And then same goes for renters. So you're a renter in these units, you're paying less than what you would on the market. That's continuous. The only difference being as a renter, you don't have to do maintenance or anything like that, which your property manager should be providing.
So developers have come up a couple of times in the conversation. You talked about the density bonus program and if that they can pay into a fund for affordable housing. Why can't developers just be required to build affordable housing in Austin? Wouldn't that solve a lot of the problems that come up in trying to provide affordable housing?
So that is a great question. And I feel like it's a question that comes up very often. Sadly, our state legislature has really bound our hands in this. That is what we would call inclusionary zoning. So essentially requiring every development that goes up to have a certain set aside of affordable housing units. Sadly, in the state of Texas, that is illegal. It is outlawed by our state legislature, and so we cannot do that. So we have our density bonus program, which essentially works on an incentive-based model. We're not requiring anyone to provide anything, but we give them an incentive in lieu of them providing us with affordable units.
So a process question about this rewrite of the land development code. There's some people who are saying they feel like it's gone really quickly and that all of a sudden, you know, here it was and council's going to vote and a hearing. But there are other people who say this has been going on for such a long time. This is the second rewrite. It's been going on for years and years. How do you feel about the pace and the speed of this rewrite of the land development code?
I'm one of those people who does believe that we have been doing this for a while. We talk about Imagine Austin Comprehensive Plan passing in 2012. Well, the work on that started 4 or 5 years before that.
And that was Imagine Austin. People might know that name or remember that phrase.
Exactly. And so one of the things that we highlighted in the Imagine Austin Comprehensive Plan was one of our key things was revising our land development codes. In 2012, as a community, we said we're going to revise our land development code. And the work on that started. And so in some ways, it seems like this process is really rushed. We're going through this right now. But at the same time, this process has been going on for a while. The other thing I want to mention is I think, you know, our community leaders, our staff, city staff, both have kept the work that people did in the Code Next process and has been guided forward. And so you will see that as you're going through the code, you will realize, oh yes, these are things that we talked about in Code Next and they're being guided forward. So I think the work that we did over the past 3 years has also not been lost completely. So we're carrying that forward. In the meanwhile, we have also, the community and otherwise, have produced a lot of work that has gone in. So, for example, our anti-displacement task force report came out in this time. Our equity office had done a SWOT analysis that went in. So a lot of that work that had happened in Code Next and after has also now been incorporated as in, and has informed this work. So in some ways, I think we have come out with a process where we really have had robust discussion on a number of items. However, I think I hear people when they say that it feels like we're moving much faster. On the Planning Commission, we had one public hearing, and Council, we're going to have one public hearing. But I think also to really let people know, the process does not end there. There's town halls happening, there's staff meetings happening. More than that, you will always have the opportunity to go and talk to your leaders and our elected leaders and talk to them at any point through this process, which will go on for a little while longer.
So you've mentioned in a couple of answers, we've talked about homeowners, we've talked about developers, we've talked about renters. Let's focus on renters for just a second. How have renters been represented in the process, and how does the Land Development Code address them? Because I think a lot of people feel like they're kind of left out, since they're not directly necessarily interfacing with all of what's happening. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the role of renters in all of this?
I think that is a great, honestly, question. And as a renter myself, that's something that's really important to me. As I said, you know, I've lived in rental homes for over 6 years in Austin, more apartments than I should care to mention at this point, because I've had to move for affordability reasons and other reasons. And so, yes, I think that voice has traditionally been left out of the conversation. In Austin, around the country, we see renters are not well represented on our, you know, in various bodies, in our advocates. But I have to say, on this process, one of the things we're fortunate, we have more council members now who are renters. So I think there's folks who are really keeping an eye on that. We also have some commissioners who are renters, so we're keeping an eye on this as well. But beyond that, I feel like I really, when I go out there and I look at my advocacy work and I'm doing that meeting communities, I do see renters are really empowered. I'm seeing a lot of renters and renters of color who are really going out there and speaking for what they think is important for themselves. So I think I'm seeing a move in the right direction. I'm very excited to see that renter movement in the city. I wish we could do more, because I do feel like renters need to have their needs represented in a much more robust way. And also, let's face it, in a lot of our conversations, in some ways, renters can be more vulnerable to displacement just because of the way the market works for them. And they do not have the ability to stay in one place if somebody wants to evict them or remove them or raise their rent.
Do you think there are any tweaks that you would like to see in the Land Development Code, or anything that in this first version maybe didn't come out in a way that is quite like you think would be most effective for affordability in the city?
I'll be honest, I think one thing that we haven't talked about that I would love to bring up is also just the gentrification displacement aspect of it. And I really have to say, we can be proud as a community that that is something we are really focusing on at this moment, both from our elected leaders, our community advocates. Everybody's really talking about gentrification displacement. And so one of the things that the code does is that if you live in tracts that have been identified as vulnerable or gentrifying within a study that was done here at UT, essentially you will have lesser development incentives in those areas. An example of that is the transition zones that we've talked about. I know folks have heard of this term. The transition zones are not as deep.
And a transition zone is essentially when you're moving from a really busy kind of main thoroughfare street and you're sort of transitioning from that into a neighborhood. It's kind of that area in between,
in the middle, exactly. And so what we've done in those areas between the what we call the corridors and our neighborhood is essentially increase entitlement, some of those missing middle housing types that I was talking about. Some of them have affordable incentives built into them, some of them not. So that essentially, when we talk about those are now going to be less deep in vulnerable areas. And I think that's an important step. And I think we really have to be cautious in how we're employing those in vulnerable areas where we're seeing a lot of displacement and gentrification. The other piece is also that multifamily conversation, and really ensuring that we do not incentivize redevelopment of multifamily is particularly, I think, important in those vulnerable areas, but definitely around the city. One thing I would mention in this regard, I think, you know, folks might have heard, Mayor Pro Tem Garza came out with this concept of an equity overlay. I will be honest, on a personal level, I'm very excited to see that. And what she's saying is really we define the geographies of areas that are vulnerable or gentrifying, and we try to really restrict any sort of redevelopment in them. We make sure the multifamily doesn't get redeveloped, and we provide increased affordable housing opportunities. So I think that for me is one of the ways which I think we looked at in the code, but we need to really do better. And I think I'm seeing that in conversations from everywhere that people are focused on that, and we're moving in the right direction.
So it's interesting the word gentrification, because I think most people hear that word and they think kind of traditionally of a neighborhood where housing costs have been lower and a developer comes in, buys up land, tears down houses, builds more expensive housing, and folks are forced out because prices are going up and they can no longer afford to stay. In this discussion about this rewrite of the land development code, there are neighborhoods saying gentrification where housing is way more expensive, and they're saying, wait, we're being gentrified too. What do you think about what I'll call the expanding concern about gentrification into neighborhoods where that has not really been a concern before?
I think one thing I will say is everyone in our city is facing pressures with taxes if you're a homeowner, right? With renters, it's there, it's just hidden. They're not seeing that direct impact of taxes. But really around the city, people are seeing a pressure of property tax. And I think, you know, our community leaders have said again and again, our elected leaders have said it again and again, a lot of this pressure, the more than the majority of it, is coming from the state. And we really hope that the state can really step up and try to help us address this issue, which is important for our community. So I think that pressure is being faced around the city by a lot of different folks. However, I think particularly when we talk about gentrification, when we talk about gentrification, one of the things that I think is important to think of is really that there's other conceptualizations around what gentrification is. And some of it is cultural erasure. It is losing minority businesses. It is losing your sense of community. And we have largely seen that on the east side. We have really seen that. And I think we would all naturally agree with this. We're seeing really a loss of a historical, traditional community, largely communities of color on the east side. And that is where I think the gentrification argument really needs to, I would say, focused. I'm not going to say that it does not need to apply beyond that, but it definitely needs to be focused in there. And I think we're seeing that. And I'll be honest, I think I'll come back to the Uprooted study done at the University of Texas. One of the things that study did was, and the city had asked the researchers to do this study, we now have areas where they have looked at various demographic data, market data, to really identify areas where there has been massive demographic change and areas where there has been a big uptake in the market. And so they've identified areas that I think give us a clear idea on where we need to focus, with, of course, the understanding that we need to be looking at the entire city, but perhaps a more razor focus on certain parts of the city. We talk a lot about the home ownership aspect, and it is very important. But I think really when we're talking about gentrification displacement, we have to talk about renters. Because in most studies around the country, in areas where we see the first people that get evicted and displaced are renters, because it's very easy to do that. You can either remove them from their apartments and try to bring them up to a better market price, or you can really tear down, evict them completely. And particularly in a state like Texas, where we have very few tenant protections, sadly, and our hands are tied in what protections we can provide by the state, we really see that it is very easy to displace and evict those people. And we're seeing that around our city. So I also want to make sure that when we're talking about displacement, we really focus on that question of renters. And that, again, goes back to the multifamily question that is everywhere within the city.
So if you take a step back, sort of from the deep, deep dive into details about the code, or the proposed rewrite of the code, if you kind of look at the proposed rewrite of the land development code, kind of the 30,000-foot view, the city has said that what was really fueling it was transportation, affordability, and housing. Do you feel like, bigger picture, that these concerns are adequately addressed in this rewrite in a way that will make the city better?
So again, this is where I'm really speaking for my own self, because it's my personal opinion. I definitely think we have moved in the right direction. And I'm very excited to see the draft that we have in front of us. And I'm excited to see the conversations that our elected leaders and community leaders are having. And I think we're moving in the right direction. So I'm very excited to see where we're going. I also want to be very careful in saying that we talk a lot about displacement and gentrification and how we're seeing teardowns of houses, and these huge houses appear in our neighborhoods that are so out of character, and we're seeing, you know, traffic become so bad. Well, a lot of these issues that we're talking about today are due to our current code. So I think we really have to put that in context and saying, here we are in this current code. The issues that we're seeing around us are being exacerbated by our current code. So we really have to move on to something better. And I'll be honest, the way our current code functions, a lot would be better than that. So I think I'm definitely excited. Are there things that we need to tweak and improve? Yes. But again, I'm very excited to see people are really focused in our community on this issue.
Avez Azar is an affordable housing advocate in the city of Austin. And Avez, we thank you so much for your time and discussion today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really great.